What happened up on the roof?
We didn't see the intruders at first because they were seething up from the underground. I couldn't figure out where they were coming from for this reason, too. The inside of the factory threw the sounds off. But soon enough, from our vantage on the roof, looking down to the factory floor through a couple of loose slats, I saw who it was. More poisoned, half-changed children, like the ones who had attacked me, spilling out of a culvert, an explosion of colors and textures and such a variety of limbs. Some had iridescent carapaces, some had gossamer wings, some had fangs like cleavers that half destroyed their mouths. Soft and exposed and pink or hardened and helmeted, they spilled out, a carnivalesque parade of killers. Some, if I were looking through Wick's eyes, would have registered as mods and others as homegrowns. Bourne's intake of breath matched mine. He didn't need binoculars, apparently, to zero in on them. He'd gone rough and prickly beside me, and a faint snuffed match / grain alcohol smell wafted over.
"More," he whispered. "More, many more, of the same."
"Hush," I said. "Hush." "Yes, more." And they looked like they had purpose, like they were on patrol. They had spears and bats and knives and machetes and a smattering of shotguns that might have been loaded or, from the way carried, used as clubs. They spread out across the factory floor, searching for something. A coldness colonized me, seeing them so small from above, their footprints and paw prints and hoof prints and boot prints leaving such a dance of marks in the dust, and our own not betraying us only because the children had frothed up like flames to obscure all that had come before. So that seeking, they had only the evidence of their own lives all around. The stairs to the roof didn't leave such traces, yet they clearly sought us, had heard us or been tracking us from below. The patterns of those footprints are what I focused on for a moment, unable to look directly at the children. I let the splinters of wood and tar pebbles from the roof cut into my palm. I wanted to be so still and so silent and so not there that those children would never think to come up to where we were, never even think to look up and perhaps catch a glint off my binoculars. Every scar on my body seemed to pulse, to burn, but pulsing there too was a need for revenge, and that I had to tamp down. I was with Bourne. I knew he'd killed 4 of them, but this was more than 20. But Bourne had no intention of going down there. Something else was coming in across his superior senses, senses that might outnumber mine. Bourne became hard, rigid, and his eyes became blowholes that pushed out curls of pink mist.
"Other creatures are coming, Rachel,"
he hissed at me like steam.
"Other things are coming now."
"Other things?"
"Not nice," Bourne was breathing. "Not nice, not nice."
And what scared me was Bourne being scared. Bourne turned the drab color of the roof and went pancake flat and spread out and tried to curl over me like a carpet was rolling me inside of it, or like he was a giant harsh tongue.
"Stop it,"
I whispered, losing my grip, binoculars jangling at my throat. "Stop it, I don't need your help." Pushing back, pulling back the edge of Bourne, "I need to see this. I need to see this." I managed to free myself from enough Bourne to lie half in and half out of his protective embrace, put the binoculars to my eyes once more. Down below, the roaring and screaming and bleeding had already begun. The wet, flopping sounds of people being taken apart. Moored proxies, pouring in from the doorway where Bourne and I had entered, smashing through the windows. "Don't look," I told Bourne. "Don't look." But how could I stop him? His entire skin was full of eyes, full of other receptors I couldn't even name. How to describe what I saw? It was a terrible, swift slaughter, possessed of an awful precision that made it hard to look away. Worse, the moored proxies were enacting a revenge I'd played out in my mind 1,000 times, sped up and preternatural. The speed shocked me the most, for they were all golden bears, all huge in their hideous beauty, much taller than a man, with thick muscles that, in their stride and bounding, came at times to the surface of their fur, like the hardness of a vine-wreathed tree trunk wrung and stretched taut. Yet they moved so lithe and sinuous, they could have been snakes or otters or flowing water pushed along in a strong current. Monstrous gold-brown blurs, they took apart the feral children with a gruff, ballet-like ease. The footprints on that dusty floor splattered with blood and offal, the arterial spray. Heads swatted from necks, gouts of dark blood from deep gouges in thighs, a kind of communal baying or shrieking from the ferals as a last half dozen formed a semicircle, soon rendered down into a chaos of viscera and exposed bone. The moored proxies lunging forward from either side in hugs that burst through fang and claw the flesh that separated them. The sharp, bitter smell of blood carried even to the roof. The smell of piss and shit, too. There were pleadings and rough refusals to submit, although the moored proxies never asked for surrender. You could not surrender to a proxy except through your death. When they were done, the factory floor had been transformed into a violent canvas of body parts and fluids, a rough, raw circle that pushed a broom or mop of reds and yellows and darker tones across its surface to create swaths and paths that almost had meaning. Here, too, were swirls and outcroppings of thicker paint that had not been smoothed out. I felt as if I were looking at a cross-section of Mord's brain. When they were done, the hummingbird quality to their movements, the blurring effect, faded, and the moored proxies became just bears again. Bears who, unlike moored, could not fly. Fur matted with blood, the bears examined the evidence of their own battle lust, waded through it, and all the while huffed and bellowed and coughed deep in their throats, went from all fours to standing on two legs to all fours again, sniffing the air, and finding it smelled good. Batted into the center the heads that hadn't been crushed flat, as they panted and hummed and mumbled their contentment. Now that the moored proxies had come to rest, I could count their numbers. 5 had slaughtered 25 ferals with hardly any effort. Yet even with no proxy casualties, I could calculate the cost. For once the initial battle lust faded, some animating impulse fled with it, and these bears moved not in normal time, but much slower, and shakes rippled through their fur, and at times, amongst the roaring and snarling, came a whimper or a moan. Something about their speed before had been unnatural. Something about it cost them now, almost like the human body coming down from amphetamines, which meant they might be vulnerable, if only you could catch them after a slaughter.
"Dirk,"
one gutturalized to another.
"Dirk, crush,"
said a third.
"Dirk, see."
With that, the fifth moored proxy, now ponderous and slow but still dangerous, began to head up the stairs to the roof where we hid, through a trail of blood. Half wrapped and born, it had made no difference when he'd extended a pseudopod to my ear and talked to me in a surreptitious way while the carnage took place. If it helped him from panicking, if it stopped him from intervening, all the better. I was like a dreamer half asleep who responds when someone talks but is not really awake yet. I was too captured by the carnage, too aware of the vulnerability of my own flesh.
Not nice, not nice,
was still in Bourne's vocabulary as the ferals died, and, less usual,
a waste. What a waste. They wasted it.
They're dying, Bourne, I said as I watched it. They're being killed.
Not here anymore. Not there, either.
Where was there? Did I want to know?
When are they doing this?
Another strange question.
Now, Bourne. They're doing it now. Right in front of you.
But I had the idea that his gaze was seeing more than mine.
Why are they doing this, though? Why?
I didn't have a good answer for that one. I didn't at all. Or for why Bourne no longer seemed frightened by it all. But now a moored proxy was pawing up the stairs to investigate the roof, and the tremors of that passage left no doubt what would happen on the roof, to me, to Bourne.
Bourne, I said, can you hide us? Hide? Hide from what?
Something in my urgency had triggered urgency in his reply.
From the bear. Bear? The thing coming up the stairs. Hide.
At a critical moment, I seemed to have hit a communication glitch, a translation problem.
Like a rock.
Can you pretend to be a rock with me inside, with room for me to breathe inside? I already knew he could be a rock, so why not? We had no other choice.
You told me not to be a rock,
Bourne pointed out.
Forget that. Forget it. You can be a rock now. Can you be a rock? Yes, I can be a rock,
Bourne said, enthusiastic.
I can put you in a rock.
And can you stay a rock no matter what happens? Can you stay a rock?
Be quiet as a rock?
The bear bounded up the stairs at a blistering pace now, recovering. The bear would be out on the roof in a moment, just a moment more.
I can stay a rock.
Can you smell like a rock, too? You must smell like a rock.
I can. Then do it, now. Yes, Rachel.
Bourne unfurled, uncurled, and rose high and came down like a crashing wave, and me tumbling in the middle of it all, bent over and half crushed by cilia and rubbery flesh. I could see nothing. I could do nothing. I was trapped within Bourne, hoping that on the outside he looked like a rock. I did not do well in truly dark places. They reminded me of other times I'd had to hide as a child with my parents, confined, in a pit, in a tunnel, in a closet, waiting to be discovered, uncovered, given away. Staying silent, still, trying not to breathe until the danger had passed. My panic in such situations had gotten worse when I reached the city, not better. The huffing of the bear came close, closer, a rabid snarl of pure animal bloodlust, but still the strangled words behind that, the muffled lunge of language forming.
Dirk, Dirk.
I was having trouble breathing, trouble controlling my breath. I was in a situation no human being had ever been in, and a situation that human beings had experienced for thousands of years. In one world, I was cocooned inside a living organism that still defied explanation. That was, no matter how I loved it, a mystery to me. In the other world, I was inside a cave, trying to hide from a wild animal. The depths of the familiar and the unfamiliar were colliding. Disoriented, I saw again the fox's strange eye. I saw again the dead astronauts. I saw the odd bit of meat left as a trap for me. I saw Mord's shuddering flank. I wanted Wick then. I wanted Wick to be there on the rooftop to tell me what to do beyond what I had done already. I wanted Wick to make things easy and to make the Mord proxy go away. Surely there was something he would know how to do. Bourne was just a child. Bourne was just a rock. A moment more, as the bear circled the Bourne rock, and the claustrophobia would have sent me over the edge. I would have cried out. I would have begged Bourne to release me. It was as if I couldn't breathe. I couldn't think. But Bourne sensed this. Bourne knew what was happening within and without. The space widened, and a dull green light came from the flesh walls all around to let me see, and a flesh book extended out of the wall, and on a shelf that formed, I saw a flesh telephone. The telephone shook like it was ringing. I picked up the receiver. "Hello," I whispered. "This is Bourne. This is Bourne calling you." "I know," I said. I felt like a child on a pretend phone having a chat with an imaginary friend. "You don't even need to make sound. I'll hear you if you mouth the words," Bourne told me. "What is going on outside?" I mouthed, even as Bourne lurched a bit from some push off to the left of me. "The bear is circling me. The bear just pushed me and I rolled a bit like a rock. But only a bit, because I'm a rock, not Bourne."
"Good. Maybe the bear will go away."
"Should I be afraid, Rachel?"
"Are you afraid, Bourne?"
"I worry the bear might eat part of me."
"Bears don't eat rocks."
"I worry that if I worry too much about the bear eating part of me, that I will stop being a rock, and then the bear might eat me."
"You must be a rock."
I willed Bourne with all the force of every secret thought to continue to behave like a rock. "I am going to end this call," Bourne said. "I think the bear is about to do something else. Goodbye."
"Goodbye, Bourne," I mouthed.
"Goodbye, Bourne, and hello, Bourne, all around me." Bourne lurched dangerously, and I put out my arms to keep my balance. I was terrified that no matter the illusion, the bear would eat through Bourne to the center, to me, and we would both die here on the rooftop for Wick to eventually find. A shudder, a recoil, a head-over-heels moment. And again, Bourne was tight and close, leaving only a globe of air around my head. The light was gone along with all of the fake things he'd created to put me at ease, and I lay there, panting, as the skin of Bourne around me, the flesh of Bourne, went prickly and rigid again, and the cilia that rubbed up against me turned into tiny mouths that screamed into my clothes, arms and legs and hair. Bourne was screaming silently into his own body because he could not scream on the outside. I had a horrible panicking, instinctual moment where I realized that the bear might be able to smell me inside the rock, and I kicked out, flailed out, then went still because each movement made Bourne constrict on me more, and it hurt to breathe. I could feel the vibration of Mord Proxy paws and Mord Proxy jaws biting into Bourne. I could sense the bear hugging and squeezing and mauling the top of Bourne, excavating the rock, savaging the rock, and me a dead person in a living coffin, preparing to be revealed as alive, to be face to face with the enormous, broad, furry head of a bear, to meet Mord's emissary. To meet death. Came the prying snarl, came the toothsome growl, so thick and loud it permeated every surface, seemed to shake my bones out of alignment, came the huffing after.
But then the bear sounds receded, and I felt through the floorboards the padding away of a great weight. When that weight transferred to the stairs, when I could feel nothing, hear nothing, I whispered, "Bourne. Bourne, are you there? Are you all right?" The cilia had stopped screaming. The flesh had stopped responding. Nothing about the Bourne around me seemed alive. I could as easily have been in something inert, in an emergency space capsule ejected from an exploding starship far from Earth, or in a one-person submarine deep beneath our deadly river, surviving within a pocket of air that would soon exhaust itself. There was that sense in my lungs of having plunged deep underground, of being so far from the surface of anything that I had no idea how I might emerge. If I would have the sick, terrible task of digging my way out of Bourne. "Bourne!" I risked a louder voice. There came an accumulated reply, a voice from everywhere and nowhere. "I am here, Rachel. I am here. I am still a rock." "Are you hurt?" I mouthed. "Parts of me I cannot feel," Bourne said. "Parts of me are gone."
"Keep still," I said. "Keep still until they've left."
"It is easier to keep still now," Bourne said, "when there is less of me to move."
He sounded odd. Not just damaged, but puzzled. His own wounding puzzled him. In the old world, when I emerged with my parents from secret rooms or tunnels or caves or closets, we knew what we were returning to, the same place we had left, as dangerous or as safe as before. We had hidden so we could remain in that world. We're saying we believed in that world no matter what, because we had no choice. Because there was no better or worse world, there was just the place we came out into. But when I emerged from Bourne, out onto the rooftop again, I did not feel the same way. We had waited until Bourne told me the moored proxies had truly gone, and all that remained below were the kinds of scavengers that would scatter at our approach. The cast-off biotech that could move, well or not so well, that came out nocturnal. We had waited until nightfall, even then, and so when I stood outside of Bourne, the world had changed in more than one sense. It was not just that Bourne had shielded me rather than the other way around. It was not the change in the sky. Pieces of Bourne had been torn from him by the moored proxy in its suspicion. These pieces had bounced like rock, settled on the rooftop like rock, but now quivered and flexed, like hands opening and closing, reformed as Bourne flesh. The Bourne that faced me was, even in that dim light, scarred and misshapen. He had returned to his normal size and shape, the one that looked like an upside-down vase, that combined attributes of a squid and a sea anemone. But he had a slumped, subdued quality that I'd never seen in him before. I winced to see that his left side was fissured and purpling black, and the ring of eyes, darkly luminous, circled his body in a haphazard way, like a rotting carnival ride, one loose bolt away from spinning off into the crowd. He had a smell like turpentine and rotting fish sticks and moldy bandages. "I'm sorry, Bourne," I said, feeling shaky. "I shouldn't have brought you out here."
Somehow they had known. Somehow they had known where we would be, but which ones? The ferals or the proxies? I was unwilling to accept that this had just been coincidence or bad luck, and also tumbling through my mind an awful sense of responsibility, that if Bourne hadn't moved out, if Bourne hadn't pretended to be more like an adult, I might not have taken the chance.
It's okay, Rachel, Born said. It's okay.
No, it's not okay.
Born's eyes flashed up at me, and another new thing, anger. And not over me saying no to him. This was a real thing, an adult emotion that had never been there before. It expressed itself through an orange-red glow, just visible at the core of him. Who knew if red meant caution to Born, but he knew it meant that to me.
It is okay, Born said. I need to learn. I need to know.
But not by being hurt.
It's not being hurt that hurts, Born said.
Born might be alien to me. He might have more senses. He might do things no human could do. But I thought I understood what he was saying. Although, did I, really? He knew now that he could be harmed. He knew now that he was vulnerable. No joy would be the same for Born. No playfulness either, because behind it would be this certain knowledge that he could die.
I'm tired, Rachel, Born said. I need not to move for a while.
That's okay, I said. And it was. If we had to make this rooftop our home for a few hours, I was prepared to do it. It had cooled as the sun disappeared and the stars came out across an unusually cloudless sky. We were silent for a long time, and I made no move to go downstairs to recon. Born needed my attention, but I also think we both dreaded going downstairs. Neither of us wanted to experience the aftermath up close, even in the dark. But Born was also looking up at the stars, all of his attention drawn there. Born was reaching out a tentative tentacle, as if to touch the stars. He must have known he couldn't, but I still said, "You can't touch them."
Why not? Are they hot?
Yes, they are. But that's not why. They're very, very far away.
But my arms are so long, Rachel. My arms can be as long as I want.
That might be so, but... I trailed off when I realized Born was joking. He had a little tell when he joked, or it was actually a big tell. Some of his eyes would drift to the left, a particular cluster. He couldn't control that.
Diabolical, he said,
still captivated by what lay above.
Diabolical, deadly, delirious, deep.
Four new words he'd been trying out, except he had not learned diabolical from me, and I felt a twinge. Some book, some other source. A normal night sky, but I was attuned to Born in that moment, and I saw it from his eyes, like a rush or an onslaught, because as far as I knew, he had never seen the night sky so unguarded before. Glimpses, maybe, from the balcony cliffs at dusk or in his books. So many stars, so little light from the city to disguise them. It was just like I remembered it from our island sanctuary so long ago, walking down the beach and not needing a flashlight because the stars were so strong. A glittering reef of stars, spread out phosphorescent, and each one might have life on it, planets revolving around them. There might even be people, like us, looking up at the night sky. It was what my mother said sometimes. To be mindful that the universe beyond still existed, that we did not know what lived there, and it might be terrible to reconcile ourselves to knowing so little of it, but that didn't mean it stopped existing. There was something else beyond all of this that would never know us or our struggles, never care, and that it would go on without us. My mother had found that idea comforting. Born's many eyes became stars as he watched them, and his skin turned the color of velvety night until he was just a Born-shaped reflection. So many eye stalks arose from him that his body flattened away to nothing,
into an irregular pool of flesh across most of the roof, the edge lapping up against my boots. I could still see how he had been injured, because he looked like a circle that had had a bite taken out of it. Each eye stalk ended in a three-dimensional representation of a star, and the stars clustered until he was a field of stars rising from the rooftop, forming nebulae and galaxies and a few fireflies like meteorites across the depth and breadth of him.
"It's beautiful," he said, from across the star field of his body. "It's beautiful."
For once, what he thought of as beautiful really was beautiful. It was as if we had become closer, even as he exhibited more alien attributes, but I quashed that with an instant of wariness. Was he truly without guile? Wasn't this repetition because of my reaction about the polluted river? But even if I suspected beautiful was just him making conversation or in some other way for my benefit, I knew that he'd taken this form to begin to heal, that there was something comforting about it, something that helped him.
"What are they?" Bourne asked. "Are they lights, like in the balcony cliffs, or electrical lights? Who turned them on?"
So whatever he'd seen in books hadn't explained stars at all. "No one turned them on," I said, realizing after I'd said it that I'd just discounted thousands of years of religion, but it was too late to turn back.
"No one?
We're on a world," I told him, not knowing what gaps existed from his reading. "We're on a world that revolves around a star, which is a giant ball of fire, so enormous that if it weren't so distant, we would all be dead, burned up. We call it the sun, and the sun is what you thought wasn't nice when it shone so bright on you the other day. But all of those points of light above are also suns, even farther away, and they all have worlds too." My eyesight had gotten blurry telling Bourne this, the aftershock of our ordeal hitting me.
"All of them? Every single one? But that's like hundreds,
thousands, maybe millions." Across the star fields of Bourne's body, there coalesced one great sun in the center, also atop a stalk. Heretical was his astronomy at this point. He'd become metaphorical or metaphysical or just silly.
"But that's incredible," Bourne said quietly. "That's amazing. That's devastating."
Then something began to blot out the stars, to turn that glittering, shining brilliance into a great and final darkness.
"And what is that?" Bourne asked, as if it was something normal,
something else he didn't know about yet, and he trusted me to tell him, to let him know what to think about it. I was speechless, because for an instant I thought the world was ending, that fate had conspired to put us on that roof to watch the end of everything. Then I realized what we were seeing, and I couldn't help a stifled chuckle. Oh, this was rich, because it was the end of the world.
"What's so funny, Rachel?"
An edge to that voice, as Bourne withdrew from the edge of my toes, drew himself up into his normal form, still sagging, still wounded. "That's Mord," I said. Yes, it was Mord, floating and diving across the night sky, high up, so huge that even from a distance he blotted out the stars. Across the night sky, the giant bear Mord glided, seething, and we could hear faint rasps and roaring from the stratosphere, the choking gasps of his rage, snuffing out first this constellation, then that one, his form as it occluded the stars, making me aware of them again. His was the greater darkness, and although I feared him and hated him and despised him, Mord was still, in that moment, the purest reflection of the city.
Mord,
Bourne said, in a kind of hissing way, and I saw, even in the reflected light, that every inch of Bourne's unscarred surface had become sharp, jagged, pointed like spears and spikes, and the eyes, now revolving, tracked Mord's obliterating progress like gun emplacements tracking aircraft. Strafed Mord's position with analytics and calculations and trajectories. He's very far away, I said, in a soothing tone. He can't hurt you. Neither statement was entirely true.
That is what you mean by Mord proxy, Bourne said. This is the source.
Yes.
They are his children.
In a way, yes.
Why would he let his children do that to other children?
I didn't have a good answer for him, but I was sure that Bourne had absorbed enough about Mord from me and from Wick that he had an idea of what he was looking at. We had turned Mord into the boogeyman in his imagination, the monster under the bed. Don't go outside, don't do this, don't do that, because Mord. But now Bourne had been mauled by one of Mord's emissaries, and he was trying to understand Mord, the real Mord. Mord continued to dip and glide and wheel and drop across the sky like a god.
Mord is beautiful, Bourne said with disdain. Mord is strong. Mord is not nice.
From his tone, I believe Bourne was beginning to parody his own innocence. Mostly not nice. Remember the not nice part. Avoid him.
He kills the stars, Bourne said. He kills the stars and brings darkness.
The stars all come back, though.
But not the people down below.
You killed four of them yourself back at the balcony cliffs, I wanted to say, but didn't.